Then I want to say they did 70, and then it went to 100 and 407. I love the guy that blamed it on She-Ra.
Right. I don't want to play with that no more. So yeah, dude. So I was at Half Price Books earlier, and I ran across this thing. It is the Sears 1982 Christmas Wish Book.
Just like a wine, that's a good year. Yeah.
And so it was $2 in the clearance section, and I'm sitting there looking at it. It's like it's a you know, what is that, 36-year-old catalog.
I'm surprised that there aren't like a whole bunch of stuff circled like I used to do when I was a kid.
I know. But I mean, you flip through this thing and it's got like old BMX bikes and camping tents. You know, obviously it's got clothes and books and toys, but like here's a page, Little Orphan Annie. And like the movie Annie was out. So you can get like curtains and sheets.
You probably got a Star Wars and a Masters of the Universe.
You got Snoopy. Oh yeah, it's all in here. But one of the funnest things, so like, you're not going to see that one anymore.
Oh, wow. The Duke boy, some good old boys.
Duke's a Hazard sleeping bag with a Confederate flag.
Huge Confederate flag on it.
You know, but Smurfs.
I remember wanting so much stuff out of those catalogs, dude.
For sure. But, you know, you turn to the end where it's the toys and the video games, so you've got like, you know, the ColecoVision, all these little handheld video games. Where's the Atari? That one was cool.
And television should be in there too, I think.
Sears Telegames. Atari video computer games. It looks like the Sears exclusive Video Arcade 2, $189. So they all had their own, you know, proprietary stuff. Let's see here. Then you've got Atari. Telegames. I think the Atari 2600 was like $100.
Yeah.
They got Masters of the Universe. They got Star Wars. I mean, I'm sitting here. Okay, Sears exclusive for the Christmas season, 1982. Sears exclusive Millennium Falcon. All of the Hoth battle stuff, the AT-AT, $46.49. That's a lot.
Brand new, sealed in the box.
But $46.
Oh, I mean, at that time, is a ton. The Castle Grayskull was only $25.
Yeah, price after rebate for classic Castle Grayskull was $25.49. And then, you know, you had the guys. You got this really cool glow-in-the-dark haunted house.
That looks awesome,
that's,
dude.
That's got all of the Universal monsters with it. The original G.I. Joe. Mortar Man, Bazooka Man, and Officer. Infantry Man, Laser Rifleman, and Machine Gunner. Explosives Commando, Submachine Gunner, and Counterintelligence Officer. So you're looking at Scarlet, Snake Eyes, Roadblock, and then some of the generic Joes that they had. I mean, this is incredible. And for three pieces, it was $7.99. They got guys from the Fall Guy, the Firebird, Smokey and the Bandit. So much fun stuff. I don't know. I can't wait to sit down and actually like dig through that for.
Yeah, well, I want to find that haunted house and see how much that one's going for.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing.
That'd make it awesome. Imagine a display with the figures and everything.
Uh huh. Which brings us to episode 71, where we're going to talk about Frankenstein.
Oh, Frank!
Frankenstein recently.
You may have heard of him.
Yeah, he recently had a birthday. Mm-hmm. 200 years old. First published January 1st, 1818. Pretty cool.
Oh yeah, has had many iterations of himself over the years.
So we're gonna get right into that here shortly. First, we're gonna take care of old business.
First, we must get into old business.
the names of some of these people. I wonder if those were really their names. They weren't just like Brian Smith, you know. February 19th, 197, Emperor Septimus Severus defeats usurper Claudius Albinus in the Battle of Lugudunum, the bloodiest battle between Roman armies. 300,000 were involved, 150,000 on each side. Casualties are unknown, but severe. When they say severe, it means there wasn't a whole lot left.
Right.
All right. On this date in 356, Emperor Constantinus II decrees closing all pagan temples in the Roman Empire. So, we used to burn the Christians, now we are the Christians. Geez, Hardcore History just recently had an episode. The title of it was Painfotainment. And he was talking about the human condition and like public executions and stuff. And he went on this long tangent about the kind of stuff that they used to do in the Colosseum and other Colosseums around Rome. Mm-hmm. And it was brutal.
Oh, yeah.
Colosseum, like they burned people.
Like, people had a bloodlust. The audience wanted to see this horrible death.
Yes. And always up until... they pretty much, everybody stopped doing public executions like in the 1930s. And they said that a lot of times the reason they stopped doing public execution wasn't because the audience wouldn't go anymore. It was because the government didn't want a whole bunch of people like all frothing at the mouth all in one spot. Mm-hmm. Because they would foster revolt.
Okay. So, it would be mob mentality.
Yeah. So, especially if they were a political person. They're right. Like, oh, we're just going to do this over here behind the closed doors and stuff.
There's somebody once, I remember years ago, somebody mentioned that Jerry Springer reminded them of the Coliseum days because people just wanted to see people, you know, failing and hurt. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, nah. Coliseum was a little bit more brutal than Jerry Springer.
Yeah, they'd make animals fight with each other. They'd make animals fight with people. They'd make people fight with people. And then during the breaks, then they'd execute the criminals. And sometimes just set them on fire. Can you imagine going to like Supercross and during the intermission, they just start setting people on fire?
And people cheering, doing the wave and everything, yeah, for like, it. Essentially, that's what was happening.
All right, in this date in 1847, the first group of rescuers reaches the Donner Party.
Donner Party of Five.
This date in 1859, New York Congressman Daniel Sickles is acquitted of murder using the temporary insanity of defense, and it was the first time it was ever used.
Dude, you've seen Training Day before, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you remember the part where the judges are in the restaurant and they're telling the story. One of them's mad, and he's telling the story about he tells them to tell Denzel Washington's character why he's upset, and there was somebody he was prosecuting that was pleading insanity. So what he did is, I don't even remember this part, but I was thinking, if I ever am on trial for something really bad that will put me in jail for a long time, I'm doing this shit. The guy had mixed a bunch of peanut butter with something and shoved it down his pants. So in the middle of the trial, in the middle of court, he reaches down the back of his pants and pulls out a handful of his peanut butter mix and starts eating it off his hand, and the judge ruled him criminally insane right there and went ahead, and so he had no chance of going to jail. He was going to the hospital.
Wow.
Yeah.
I was listening to a podcast. It was like political discussion, and you know, some of this stuff gets very controversial, especially today. But they were talking about like kind of the whole trans movement and like how, okay, so it was the Joe Rogan podcast. And Joe Rogan was like, well, I can't remember her name. He does. He was mentioning her. But there was some guy who was a UFC fighter who disappeared from the sport, went and had a sex change operation, came back and entered and was fighting women.
Yeah.
And was beating the hell out of
them. Yeah, I remember that. It was South America, if I'm not mistaken.
I'm not sure. But so Joe Rogan was on the side of like, this chick should not be able to fight.
No.
because biologically he's like, and it's not that she's bigger and strong. It's not that she's better. It's she's bigger and stronger. So, you know, bone density and muscle mass and all this other stuff. And he was just going to town on all of these women, just beating the hell out of them. And the guy that was interviewing was like, he's like, it's so weird. Well, Joe Rogan was like, yeah. And then I get all this hate mail because it's like, oh, you know, if she felt like she was a woman, then she's a woman. And Joe Rogan's like, she impregnated another female with her dick. Was she a woman then? She's like, yes. He's like, so does that mean that, like, if Hillary Clinton was running against Donald Trump and Donald Trump was about to lose the election to Hillary Clinton, then all Donald Trump had to do was come out and be like, well, I've always felt like I was a woman. Now he's like, they have to accept that.
Yeah, essentially, as a woman,
you have to accept that. And it's like, it's just this weird sort of, you know, but temporary insanity is kind of like that.
Yeah.
It's like you just got like, like, did is it or isn't it? And what's the truth? It's strange. All right, in this date in 1878, Thomas Edison patents the phonograph. So you can kick back and listen to Inagata De Vita.
Game changer.
Absolutely. All right, notable births. Happy birthday, 1473, to Nicholas Copernicus, astronomer extraordinaire.
Strong name.
1924, Mr. Dirty Dozen, Lee Marvin.
Mm-hmm.
1940, Smokey Robinson.
The smooth, soulful sounds.
1948, Mr. Black Sabbath, Tony Iommi.
Okay.
1955, Jeff Daniels.
Nice.
That dude has been in so many roles.
Yes, he has.
But he's most famous for Dumb and Dumber.
Yeah.
That's the thing that he's going to be remembered for the rest of his life, is Dumb and Dumber.
Arachnophobia was incredible.
Well, Dumb and Dumber, though.
Yeah. There's a dude from Dumb and Dumber, ain't it?
1957. Doesn't have a last name, but Falco, the guy who did Rock Me on Amadeus. 1967, Benicio del Toro. And, man, we're really getting into some new territory here. Happy birthday in 2004 to Millie Bobby Brown. She's the one that plays 11 on Stranger Things.
Okay.
She's young.
Yeah, she is.
That makes her like 14 now?
Yeah. She's been doing it for, what, 3 years now?
Yeah. And on this date, in 1980, we lost Mr. Bon Scott of AC/DC.
Okay.
So that is it for old business. I'll take a quick break,
yeah,
and we will come back with some information about Frankenstein.
When this dead hand moves, the monster created by a man they called Mad is turned loose to strike terror into the hearts of men. To shock women into uncontrolled hysteria.
Elizabeth!
To prey upon the innocence of children. This is the story you've heard about, talked about. The spine-tingling, blood-chilling story that stuns your emotions. Frankenstein.
Don't touch that!
And we're back with a little bit of new business for you. Okay, so you know the Tremors television series is eventually coming. So in between, we get a new Tremors movie. Get number six, Tremors: A Cold Day in Hell. The film synopsis, Burt Gummer, Michael Gross.
Mm-hmm.
Burt and his son Travis Welker, played by Jamie Kennedy, find themselves up to their ears in graboids and ass blasters. You remember the ass blaster from number three, I think is where the ass blaster came from. When they head to Canada to investigate a series of deadly giant worm attacks, arriving at a remote research facility in the Arctic tundra, Burt begins to suspect the graboids are secretly being weaponized by someone to use for their own gain. But before he can prove his theory, he is sidelined by a graboid venom. With just 48 hours to live, the only hope is to create an antidote with fresh venom. But to do that, someone would have to figure out how to milk a graboid.
Nice.
So it's supposed to be a horror comedy, more funny than the normal Tremors.
I remember the first Tremors was kind of unexpected because it was like kind of built as a comedy, but it
held up, dude.
The one dude like starved himself up on that telephone
pole.
Yeah,
yeah, he was all just his skin was starting to peel off and everything. It was nuts. Okay, I think somebody from Florida might have moved to Scotland.
Uh-oh. What happened?
Okay, Scottish farmer, Mr. Bruce Grubb, 24 years old. He was throwing a housewarming party. All of a sudden, he spotted something, called the cops, and said, "Hey, got a tiger in my cow shed. This tiger's about to kill my cows. I need you guys to get here quick." After a 45-minute standoff, they realized it was a stuffed animal somebody had placed as a joke in his cow shed. It took 45 minutes
for them to
realize that it's not moving. It's a stuffed animal.
Have you ever seen Scottish Twitter?
No, I haven't.
You read it and you can't understand it. So it's what's funny about it. It's just like, what is this?
Okay, I've been looking at Chick Lively for videos all the time. And they use Google Translate for some of the descriptions. It's the funniest shit you've ever read, man. It just makes no sense with the videos. Okay, turning to actual Florida. Okay. This story just cracks me up. Domestic battery triggered by a sting song. Now, I'm thinking it probably wasn't as much of the song as it was the way this dude was probably singing it to his significant other.
Roxanne!
No. A domestic dispute between a Florida couple turned violent after one of the men, it was two men, they went to the bedroom and began playing If You Love Somebody, Set Them Free by Sting. It drove his partner so nuts, he ran in there, grabbed his boyfriend, pushed his head against the wall, ripped his shirt, bit him on the lip, and just went nuts on him. But I can imagine the guy in the other room, If you love someone, set them free. Just hollering at him, giving him a hint that he wants to go.
Dude. Sometimes you have like things that are pointed out to you in certain perspectives, and you're like, you know, I never really thought of it like that. But years ago, I used to work. Our office was down over Westheimer and Montrose. And for those of you who are not familiar with Houston, the Montrose area has a very, very high gay population.
Yep.
It's one of the highest gay populations in the country, actually. Or it was then. I don't know how it is now, since things have gotten expensive and gentrified, whatever. But very, very high gay population. So anyway, I'm working at the office, and one of our cargo vans got sideswiped. Or, you know, somebody hit it and dented the door. So I had to run down. And it was sitting in the driveway when it happened. So I had to run down. There's a little police substation just about a block from our office. So I had to go down there and get a police report on a hit and run, basically. So I go down there and fill out my report or whatever. And these two guys are talking. And they're like, well, what ended up, you know, these two cops are sitting there talking with each other. I'm filling out the thing. And he's like, oh, man, you know, there was blood everywhere, and the place was wrecked. And we ended up having to take both of them in, and blah, 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 blah. And he's like, and then they started, you know, trying to, and I was like, you know, kind of like, what happened? And the desk clerk guy kind of rolled his eyes. He's like, I was like, what's up? He's like, so when there's a domestic disturbance call, when there's a fight, and we have to go in. He says, the problem is, he says, normally it's like a husband and a wife, and maybe she hit him, maybe he hit her, you know, whatever, and you can pretty much figure out what went wrong, and, you know, even if it's her fault, if he hit her, we have to take him in, and blah, blah, blah. He's like, when you go to some of these houses, you know, when these couples are gay, he says, first of all, they're very body proud, so they spend a shitload of time at the gym, and they're just, like, muscled up. He says, then they get upset, and their emotions get running, and they start fighting, and they'll tear their shit apart. Just absolutely tear their
passion.
Just beat the hell out of each other. He says, so then you show up to the domestic disturbance call, and you got these two roided out dudes crying with a completely destroyed house. And they're both so beaten up that you can't really tell who was the aggressor or whatever, because obviously both of them were punching. Right. So you have to take them both in. And so you got these guys that are just like hulked out, like muscle-bound guys, crying their asses off, being led away from their destroyed apartments. And he's like, and this happens like every week. He's like, it's weird. I never thought of it it's like that thing. Before, but I guess when the emotions run high, you know, you don't have that. You can't hit a girl rule. Whatever.
Right. It's yeah. Thing, it's all out.
It's like up yours. Bah! I'm like, man. Anyway, so I guess that's the end of new business, or do you have more?
Yes,
new
I'm
business?
Done. We can move forward.
Let's take another quick break, and we'll come back to the modern Prometheus.
We'll be here.
Oh, Frederick, are you all right?
Yes. Would you excuse me for 1 minute, dear?
Oh, of course, Doctor.
Igor? May I speak to you for a moment?
Of course.
Sit down, won't you?
Thank you.
No, no, up here. Oh,
thank you.
Now, that brain that you gave me, was it Hans Delbrück's?
No.
Ah, good. Would you mind telling me whose brain I did put in?
And you won't be angry?
I will not be angry.
Abby someone.
Abby who?
Abby Normal.
Abby Normal.
I'm almost sure that was the name.
Are you saying that I put an abnormal brain into a 7.5 foot long, 54 inch wide gorilla? What? Is that what you're telling me? Wait, quick, get up.
There's a curse on our village. The curse of Frankenstein.
Was Frankenstein, that your mother was the lightning,
the most dreaded creation of man. The monster of Frankenstein stalks again. Here is drama completely strange, full of weird suspense, with this great cast: Sir Cedric Hardwicke, Lionel Atwill, Ralph Bellamy, Bela Lugosi, Evelyn Ankers, Lon Chaney. In the gripping tale of a monster the tomb cannot engulf, chains cannot hold.
You're going to give him life?
Yes. Not for the purposes that you think, Igor. I'm giving him another brain.
Is that your shower, Husman?
Yes, yes.
We'll be right back.
And we are back. So, let's see here. Where do we start with Frankenstein? Frankenstein is probably one of the most recognizable monsters.
By far.
Ever. In just about any genre.
Right.
And
he just, there's been so many iterations of Frankenstein over the years, from, you know, cartoons to sitcoms to movies, books, everything, man. It there's no... Pretty much everyone has been touched by Frankenstein some way or another.
It was really a truly inspired work. And some of the things that it's just hard to believe. I mean, it's just like certain things happen. Stars cross in a certain way. They just line up. Frankenstein or Modern Prometheus was written by Mary Shelley. Mary Shelley being the wife of poet Percy Bysshe Shelley.
Mm-hmm.
Who was famous and working, and Percy and Mary were both friends with Lord Byron, who was a famous poet and libertine. And he and Lord Byron invited the Shelleys and another friend, Dr. Polidori, up to his estate, and they were supposed to have like a weekend and play and, you know, ride horses and
just relax.
But the weather turned bad, so they were stuck in the house. So Byron suggested that they have a ghost. They all write a ghost story, and you know, try to write the best story. So Percy started playing with some poetry, and Byron was going over some vampire lore that he had heard about whenever he was on his travels. And Mary didn't have any ideas. She was just kind of sitting there, you know, trying to play along, but she didn't have anything that she could really form out and whatever. She was uninspired. She
right.
Didn't. But Mary had a dream, and when she woke up, she dreamed of a scientist who created life and then was horrified by his creation. And so she woke up and she started, you know, sketching it out.
Mm-hmm.
And Frankenstein. She started writing it when she was 18 years old, and it was published anonymously when she was 20.
Right. Her name wasn't on the initial print.
Her name wasn't, because at that time, women didn't get a whole lot of credit for writing stuff. But it was such a commercial and critical hit that the second edition did have her name on
right.
it.
Right. She was given the credit for it.
And from then, nobody ever looked back. And we will get, you know, further into Frank here in a second. But what's interesting to note, like I said, about how the stars align. I mentioned it on another episode just recently, and I didn't have the names or whatever. But,
yeah.
But while Mary was writing Frankenstein, Polidori wrote The Vampire. And using some of Byron's vampire lore, The Vampire was just a short story, but it is also the progenitor of the romantic vampire genre.
Mm-hmm.
So he is almost a direct ancestor of Dracula and any kind of royal court gentleman vampire.
Yeah.
So prior to The Vampire, it was all revenants, zombies, and folklore.
Mm-hmm.
But on that same weekend that Frankenstein was born, basically so was Dracula.
Right.
It's really, really neat. At the same place, at the same time.
There was a lot of star power in that house.
Yes. And it's just really...
Arguably the two biggest horror creations.
Ever.
Ever.
Yes.
Same night. Same rainy weekend.
Yes.
You know, think about it. If the weather wouldn't have been good, they never would have took this exercise.
Exactly. And it's just crazy how that all worked out. Shelley was actually inspired and says that, you know, she traveled and stuff when she was young. But she traveled through Europe in 1814 to Germany with a town called Jernstein, which is near Frankenstein Castle, where two centuries before an alchemist was engaged in experiments. Then she went to Switzerland, where stuff like galvanism and other occult ideas were themes of conversation among her companions.
Mm-hmm.
Spiritualism was kind of gaining ground at this point.
Right.
So it was kind of hot to speak about, you know, esoteric
right.
subjects. So she did have some tools in her toolbox. But just to imagine an 18-year-old. Have you read Frankenstein? It is thick.
Oh, yeah. It's a huge book.
It's well, no, I don't mean the book itself is thick. It is. The language is thick.
Yeah, but I've read the one that Bernie illustrated.
And that's the same one.
Yeah, it's the same one.
And then thematically, I mean, it's so deep.
Mm-hmm.
It's in its meanings and yeah, symbolism. Yeah,
in its meaning and symbolism, exactly. It's a very deep book, man, because it's everything from a man's own struggles within himself, Dr. Frankenstein, you know, it's a hugely, hugely deep book.
You know, allegories.
It's not a simple novel.
Allegories for God and man, mm-hmm. with, you know, God creates man, then he's disappointed by his creation because it isn't what he wanted it to be or thought it should be.
Right.
So he actually tries to destroy it, and it survives, and, you know, pretty much actively spurns him.
Yeah, it comes for retribution. It comes for revenge.
You know, so much dark material in Frankenstein. Since the novel's publication, Frankenstein has often been used to refer to the monster itself. This usage is sometimes considered erroneous, but usage commentators regarded as well-established and acceptable. That still bugs me.
The Frankenstein monster.
The Frankenstein's monster, yeah. I mean, the creation, Frank, you know, the monster did not earn his creator's name.
Right.
In fact, he went really far in trying to destroy his creator.
Yeah.
In the novel, the monster is identified by words such as creature, monster, demon, wretch, abortion, abomination, fiend, and it. And in Frankenstein, the wretch refers to himself as the Adam of your labors. He's also referred to someone who would have been your Adam, but is instead your fallen angel, which ties to Lucifer in Paradise Lost, which the monster reads, and which relates to the disobedience of Prometheus in the book's subtitle.
Mm-hmm.
So, the book is such, you know, Victor Frankenstein, he's a young medical student, and he comes across the secret of life.
Yeah.
And he creates, he basically takes the secret and he animates.
He reanimates.
Reanimates, well, yeah. Does, in the book, I don't remember, he didn't reanimate so much as he put together and then animated.
And animated, yeah.
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 So, I mean, it was corpse parts, but he didn't reanimate a specific
person. Right.
It was a bunch of
monstrosity. It was an abomination.
Victor runs away and leaves the monster alone to just kind of fend for himself. And the monster spends time learning about itself in mm-hmm. the world, reading,
and coming up with his own opinions, his own views of everything.
But everywhere he goes, he's shunned.
Yeah, no one accepts him.
He's frightening. He's big, and he's can't really talk well, and he doesn't know anything, and he's not accepted. Let's see. He finally makes a friend with the blind man, but whenever the blind man's family come home,
yeah,
they freak out, and he and the creature ends up freaking out and burning their house down.
Yeah.
And
then he's looked upon as a monstrosity and something that needs to be done away with.
So then he figures out who Victor Frankenstein is. He goes back to the state and ends up killing William and framing Justine for the murder. And mm-hmm. then she ends up getting executed for the murder that the monster commits. The creature demands a mate.
Yeah.
Which Victor begins to make for him, but then most of the way through says he's not going to do
it. He's not going to do it.
And it sends the creature into an even further rage. And in the end, Victor tries to chase the monster down. And then the monster kills his fiance on their hunt, on their wedding night.
Mm-hmm.
And then kills Victor. And then hops on an iceberg and floats away.
He heads out.
So, there was a lot of murder and death.
Oh, yeah.
In this story.
somewhat, it's interesting because the book, it like tries to make a sympathetic character of the creature, but in the end, with the creature killing the fiance and everything, it kind of loses that. It's really a back and forth between, you start feeling sorry for the creature, and the creature does something really stupid,
yeah,
really horrifying, and you go back to not liking him.
Right, and that's the thing is, you know, the creature is a sympathetic sort of thing. He is the product of, I don't want to say society, but he is the product of his creator. So, like,
he's part of his creator, but his personality and just the downfall of him, that's a product of society in a way they shunned him.
Well, right. Well, that's what I mean. Is he goes and he's like, hey, you make me a mate and I'll leave you alone. Then Victor kills his mate, and so he's like, well, screw you, I'll kill yours. You know?
Yeah.
So his response is pretty brutal.
Top.
It's over the top and pretty brutal. But it's not really, I mean, he's going to be alone, so why not? You know, like, so he still stays sympathetic. He just, like you say, though, he does
stuff to make you not want to see him do well.
Yeah, he's got to go. He's a multi-murderer. he really is a mass murderer as far as it goes. So let's see here. We were talking about whether or not he was built. Although the creature would be described in later works as a composite of whole body parts grafted together from cadavers and reanimated by the use of electricity, this is not consistent with Shelley's work. Both the use of electricity and the cobbled together image of the monster were more the result of the film adaptation in 1931 mm-hmm. and other early motion picture works. In the original work, Frankenstein discovers a previously unknown but elemental principle of life, and that allows him that with electricity and magnetism, as well as gunpowder and other chemical reactions. So that's what allows him to reanimate, or to animate the corpse. So the 1931 movie.
Yes.
I remember seeing that when I was a teenager. And when I was a teenager, you had movies like Beetlejuice, Edward Scissorhands, which is almost kind of a gentle retelling of Frankenstein.
Yeah.
Like, what if Victor Frankenstein was a benevolent creator mm-hmm. and had the best interests of his creation at heart,
right?
You'd have Edward Scissorhands, who was not human and did kind of have that disconnect between what should be and what is. He was not really equipped to deal with the world, and his extremities were violent weapons.
Yeah, yeah.
But I remember seeing that 1931 movie, and that's the monster's supposed to be scary, but he's very sympathetic in the movie.
Yeah.
And when he ends up getting burned in the
windmill, you feel bad for him. He's like a child.
Yes. When he ends up getting burned in the windmill in the end, you really feel bad for him.
He's like a child. He's not like a conscious adult that mm-hmm. That can think for himself and everything, which makes him very sympathetic in the movie.
You know, and then so many iterations and video games. I mean, he's a ubiquitous character.
Right.
You have things like Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, and
you got Herman Munster.
Yes. And just so many different iterations of the monster as both comedic and horrific. excuse me.
The Scary Dad logo.
Yeah. Well, had to get a recognizable character, right?
Right.
And there he is. But there's always been a very special place in my heart for Frankenstein.
Oh,
because,
definitely.
You know, I remember reading the book, I guess when I was in high school, I suppose. And high school was a strange place because I was always a big reader.
Mm-hmm.
I remember getting in trouble for reading stuff that either wasn't part of the story or reading too far ahead. We're on chapter 3. I'm like, I'm done with the book. Let's talk about it, you know. But I remember reading Frankenstein, and I remember, I'm not going to say that I didn't like it, but it was maybe just because it was part of a curriculum. You know, you kind of hit home. And I saw that metaphor right away, you know, all that metaphor for, like, I wasn't familiar with, like, Dante and Milton and Paradise Lost and all of that stuff, but all of those allegories between creator, created, fallen angel, you know, the fall of man, you know, it's like getting into the religious aspect is like, okay, you have Adam and Eve in the garden, and you know, you have God, and he's like, okay, well, you can do anything you want, but just don't do this one thing. Well, of course, that one thing is what everybody wants to do.
Mm-hmm.
But you equipped your creation with free will. What did you think was going to happen?
Right.
That's not to excuse the behavior, but you can't be so surprised whenever you build a creative and curious creature that then turns around and wants to look in the box that you said not to open, that you didn't lock. You know, so I saw all of that, and I used to think that Frankenstein was a little bit preachy, but then whenever I was an adult and I read it, and I saw how much more of the deeper themes of science gone awry, and not God and man, but man trying to take the place of God, and all of the stuff that we have with science and nuclear technology and genetics and all the things we can make. And that was about the same time as the killer bees got away and they start killing people, and you're like, kind of like Jurassic Park, you know, you sat around, like, you spent so much time thinking about whether or not you could, you didn't stop to think of whether or not you should. And so, I mean, Frankenstein, for being 200 years old, is probably one of the most topical fiction pieces from literature.
Oh, yeah, it was more than just a horror book.
That still just stands up to our own morality
right
today, you know?
A lot still applies. A lot of the stuff that was...
You're playing God with nature.
Right.
This was not meant for you. And according to the Florida people, like you said, who grew a human ape and then rapidly killed it afterwards.
Yeah, when they realized they made a mistake.
That we just talked about that, 2 weeks ago?
Man, the Boris Karloff Frankenstein was just insane.
Yes. I mean,
that is like the quintessential Frankenstein. You know, it... not to take anything away from Bernie Wrightson's...
Well, let's talk about Bernie Wrightson. So Bernie Wrightson illustrated Mary Shelley's novel.
Yep.
He didn't rewrite it. He didn't reimagine it.
He did illustrations to go along with her original work.
He chose scenes, and he ended up illustrating them in such a way. And if you've never seen Bernie Wrightson's illustrations for the Frankenstein novel, you are really missing out.
The detail is insane.
You can sit there and look at some of these pictures, and
everything's there.
It's so much, it's, you know, like you pointed out, it's like, hey, look at that other corpse that's sitting on the table.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the bride.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, that's when...
But you don't... You're like, it's just a picture of you know, the monster and Frank kind of like bowing up against each other. You don't... You know, the context of the scene until you really look at the picture, and then you're like, oh.
You see the anger in the monster's face, and you know why.
Yes.
He captured it very well.
I want to get a nice first edition of that one.
I wish I could have got mine signed. It's the only thing that I regret never being able to do. And of course, you had the Gene Wilder.
Young
Frankenstein. Frankenstein!
Which is a Mel Brooks comedy, but it still had its moments.
Yes, it did.
You know,
but it's a great movie. It's a great adaptation of the
original. Whose brain did I put in here?
Abnormal.
Are you telling me I put an abnormal brain in a 12-foot, 400-pound monkey? Are you telling me that? Yeah. I'm not.
when Igor first meets him, he's like, it's Frankenstein. He goes, well, it's Igor.
Yeah.
Isn't it Igor? No, it's Igor.
Yeah. And then, so, in fact, so I think I saw Young Frankenstein before I probably saw the original one.
Okay.
So that was kind of my base. But, you know, the lightning, the manic stuff of it's alive. And then he sits up and he's like, oh, crap, look what I just did.
It even influenced Weird Science.
Nope.
The whole Weird Science thing. There's been so many influences in this movie and just pop culture. It's unreal.
Well, I don't think without Frankenstein, I don't think you really have zombies.
Right. He's the original zombie.
You know.
He's the original Walking Dead.
Just like with, if you don't have that rainy weekend, you don't have vampires.
Right.
You know, like, which we've done a couple episodes on vampires, but I don't think we ever got to the core of it. But,
yeah.
Or, you know, to the root. But it's amazing that Dracula and Frankenstein were pretty much born on the same day.
Yeah.
You know,
and just the impact they've had. You know, it's phenomenal, man, when you think about it.
And an 18-year-old girl had a bad dream and sat up and wrote it down.
Yeah.
I mean, she was a very, very well-written 18-year-old girl, but damn. Can't think of what I was doing when I was 18. I sure as hell wasn't traveling around Germany, you know, writing stories about alchemists and stuff. Man, I also remember, like, years and years ago, there was a video game that came out. It was like the Universal Monsters. It was kind of like a mod grab of Street Fighter,
mm-hmm.
but it had like Dracula and Frankenstein, right. and Wolfman or whatever. Frankenstein was always fun because he's just like so big and you just pound on things.
Like the Hulk.
That was a good one.
He's like the Hulk, man. Yeah, Frankenstein has definitely been an influence in my life and so many other folks.
Well, then you mentioned Herman Munster.
Yeah.
You know,
he's Frankenstein.
It's funny because I remember, obviously, you know, Herman Munster, he's a comedic, you know, but Fred Gwynne playing Herman Munster, he's the monster. He is Frankenstein's monster. He is the monster.
He even has the bolts on his neck.
But then you see him in Pet Sematary, and it's so much scarier.
Yeah, he's creepier than that one for sure, dude.
You know, shit, we just talk about, like, Swamp Thing. I'm sure Swamp Thing was influenced in some way by Frankenstein.
Yeah.
You know, just being away from society and always...
And shunned. And,
you know, always looking for something.
Misunderstood.
So, just so much in... You know, I already mentioned Edward Scissorhands. Just so, mm-hmm. so much in... even Friday the 13th, Part 6.
Yeah, he's reanimated.
They reanimate him with lightning. And he comes back as kind of a zombie Frankenstein Jason, you know. He's not looking to make friends.
He doesn't want a wife or anything.
He does like to poke women, but
but he still digs the single scene.
But yeah, if you haven't checked out the any of these movies or books, I highly recommend, you know, grab yourself a copy of Frankenstein. If you can, get the Bernie Wrightson version, the illustrated version.
Yeah, you'll enjoy the illustrations.
It'll bring a whole new depth to everything. Took Bernie Wrightson 7 years to illustrate this book. And I don't think that book is...
The big push was the final 2 years.
Well, I don't think the book... It's not super thick, full of illustrations.
No, it's not.
There's a lot of really, really detailed ones.
Yeah. Yeah, as I said, the detail within the pictures themselves, it's amazing what he was able to do. You know, his interpretation of her words.
Yes. But yeah, so I guess, you know, from now we got to do, you know, next time, maybe not next week, but next, you know, our next one, we're going to cover the Gill Man.
Yeah.
I hear The Shape of the Water is coming back around to... It'll be out on video soon.
Okay, cool.
Yeah,
we need to watch that, and then we go ahead and go over that one.
Because so many of these characters, I mean, Monster Squad did it best, just kind of pulling them all together in mm-hmm. one movie. In one movie. But there was really a in the 30s there was really a trend with getting all of these monsters together. And,
right.
You know, they play their own scenes, and then they play in each other's movies.
Make cameos.
When Frankenstein meets the Wolfman, and, you know, than Abbott and Costello, and just, you know, different comedic stuff, and they reuse each other's sets and things of that nature. So those old horror movies are fun to watch, you know, with all the smoke in the graveyard.
Yeah, they are, just to see the way they used to have to do practical effects. They didn't have, you know, the special effects teams that we have today.
Yeah.
Just what they could do with what they had to work with was pretty impressive, to say the least.
Absolutely. But yeah, I think that might go ahead and put a fork in the end of Frankenstein, unless you got some more stuff to...
No, the only thing I was going to bring up is the 2015, we talked about it before, the 2015 adaptation of Frankenstein. It's a modern-day adaptation of the story, directed by Bernard Rose. It is a definitely good watch.
Well, we didn't go through necessarily all the movies.
There's been a lot.
There have been a lot. You know, I guess we could get into the Bride of Frankenstein, wearing this, going off of the book now, you know, where Victor didn't make the bride and then ends up getting killed, and then end of story. Whereas in the movies, he ends up making a bride.
Yeah.
And he has a whole different sort of thought process behind things.
Right.
So, you know, you've got The Bride of Frankenstein, and then there was that 80s movie with Sting called The Bride, mm-hmm. which was actually kind of creepy.
That was weird.
That was a weird movie. But there's so much Frankenstein lore. I mean, we could just sit here and talk for probably hours.
Oh, yeah.
But I just wanted to kind of touch on
the monster.
The history and the monster and the mythos. How crazy it is that the vampire came around the same time. You know, just, again, stars aligned.
Yeah, and we ended up with two of the greatest horror characters ever.
So cool. I think that's going to close me out, man. What you think?
Sounds good to me, man.
Awesome.
Till next time.
Just keep it scary.
Later.